Event. I'm Barbara Buffalo. I have the privilege of being the mayor of Columbia, Missouri, and I'm so thankful to have such a good turnout on a beautiful, beautiful Good Friday. So thank you all for being here. We're here to celebrate, this is Fair Housing Month, which was passed in 1968. And, you know, the purpose of it is it was civil rights legislation that prohibits housing discrimination. And this is based on race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability, or familial status. And I want to thank that we have an expert here in Columbia with Professor Rigel Oliveri from the MU Law School, who is renowned. Well, I feel like you're one of my nationally known friends for being a fair rights lawyer and teaching our law students on these facts. One of the things that we talk about in the City of Columbia is the importance of treating everyone fairly, but it takes partnerships to do that. I'm thankful the City of Columbia has great partners with Columbia Housing Authority, our Columbia Board of Realtors, and so many more in this room that come together to really address the housing needs of our community. We are not unique in having struggles with having enough housing for people. This is something that is a nationwide trend. This is something, though, that we are focused on. The City of Columbia and Boone County have partnered strongly on addressing the housing needs of our community. We want to make sure we continue that progress, regardless of what happens at a national level. This is a local effort that we continue to do. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce, who am I introducing? Randy. Okay, see, I love when people just tell me what to do. So I'd now like to welcome up one of our great partners, Randy Cole, the director of Columbia Housing Authority. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you. I'm going to be pretty quick here, but I'm really pleased and honored to introduce our keynote speaker today, and that's Rigel Oliveri. I know her as a commissioner on the CHA Board of Commissioners, so that's a really important role where she brings both accountability and support to me and the organization and our mission. So I'm really pleased to be able to say a few words about Rigel as we move forward here. She's a nationally recognized expert in fair housing law, housing discrimination, zoning, property rights, and sexual harassment. Her work has been published in leading legal journals and cited by both state and federal courts. She's also co-editor of the Legal Guide to Affordable Housing Development, and she's given me a copy of that, so it's a really thick read. But beyond her academic and professional accomplishments, she's a deeply committed advocate for our community. One example that I would like to share is Rigel played a critical role in bringing our Kenny Point apartments from vision to reality. There was special funds to that project through HUD that required an additional fair housing analysis for the project that needed to be performed by a local entity. But our community didn't have that local entity, so Rigel stepped in. And thanks to her expertise, she was able to conduct the review and demonstrate that Kenny Point was in a desirable location. So without her, that project would have probably faced some further delays and costly delays. So I'm very appreciative of her expertise. So I'm incredibly grateful for expertise and thoughtful, informed leadership. And with that, I'm thrilled to welcome her as our keynote speaker.
Thank you, Randy. Thanks, Mayor Buffalo. And thank you all for being here. This is a great turnout. On a lovely day. I wish my students were this good about coming to class in the spring. So I'm going to talk about two things today. I'm going to talk about sort of fair housing law and developments in the law, and then I'm going to pivot and talk specifically about the Columbia Housing Authority and some of the initiatives that it's been working diligently on as well. So the way I'd like to do it is I'm happy to take questions while I'm talking. I'll also pause between when I shift focus, so if people have questions that they want to wait and ask, then that's fine too. So I guess to begin, as Randy and Barb said, my passion is fair housing. I started my career as a fair housing lawyer at the Department of Justice. I came here to MU to teach the subject, and I'm actually proud to announce that we've just come out, myself and some co-authors have just published the very first casebook on fair housing law, which has just gone to print recently, so it's pretty exciting. one of the things that I've always felt about this subject is that as deeply important as it is to every person and every neighborhood and every community, it is one that doesn't get talked about or taught about nearly enough. When we wrote the book that just came out, it's the first book. There isn't one that is meant for law school teaching until ours, and that really says something. And my goal in most of what I do is just to try to get these subjects out there and help people think and talk about these issues, become more educated on them, think about how they relate to them, to their own communities and things like that. So I hope we can do that today. I want to begin today, as I always begin whenever I teach fair housing law to my students, I always want to start with some of the history. You know, my students, many of them are born in the early aughts, so this seems very old to them. But I think it's important for them to know. For many of us, we know this, but not everyone does. So I like to start off by talking about why April is Fair Housing Month. And to talk about that, we want to go back to the movement for fair housing. It started in earnest in 1965. Obviously, there'd been a lot of legal developments and advocacy before that, but it was in 1965 that Dr. King initiated what was called the Chicago Freedom Movement, but it was called the Chicago Freedom Movement for Open Housing. And what he was doing, what the movement was doing, was kind of, they'd had the March on Washington, which was the March for Jobs and Freedom. That was to get employment discrimination law passed and public accommodations to be desegregated. Their next move was to pivot from that and start looking at housing. The next piece of big civil rights legislation was supposed to be the Fair Housing Act. So what Dr. King did was he took the movement from the South and brought it up to the North, the Northern Midwest, and staged marches there. He actually temporarily relocated there, living in kind of a slum building to bring attention to the conditions of the housing up there. And he was met with the fiercest resistance, he says, that he had ever encountered. He said that what he saw in the streets in Chicago was much worse than what he had faced in Alabama and Mississippi and places like that. So I like to show my students some of these pictures. And I like to show them some of the pictures in color, because we remind them this did happen during a time when there was color photography. So the plan was that the fair housing law was going to be, the bill was going to be introduced in 1966. The bill that had been the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the one that had dealt with public accommodations and employment, had passed. And so they thought the next will be 1966, the Fair Housing Act will get passed. And here's actually what happened. It failed. It came up to a vote. And interestingly, some of the people who had supported civil rights in employment and civil rights in public accommodation couldn't quite bring themselves to support it when it came to housing, because suddenly they were hearing from their constituents how very uncomfortable that made them. So even sort of more liberal-minded members of Congress who were happy to kind of desegregate lunch counters and have equal opportunity in employment balked when it came to housing, and the matter never made it even to a vote. It didn't get out of committee. The summer of 1967, there was massive urban unrest in cities throughout the United States for a lot of complicated reasons, but one of them had to do with really deplorable segregated housing conditions. This was highlighted by the report. It was the President's Commission on Civil Disorders, commonly known as the Kerner Commission, that President Johnson actually convened to help figure out why did these incidents happen all across the United States that caused a lot of property damage and a lot of death. At the same time as this commission was deliberating, a new fair housing bill was introduced in Congress, and it once again was pretty well destined to fail. Everyone, that was the consensus view. The Kerner Commission report came out, and one of the things it did was recommend that we have a fair housing law. So that helped get it out of committee in the Senate and get passed by the Senate, but then it went to the House, and it was dying in the House. There was fairly consensus view that the House was not going to let it get out. And then some events happened in a very short one-week period of time that basically compelled this issue right to the forefront, and that was the assassination of Dr. King Within a week, the measure was passed by the House without needing to reconcile, which is ordinarily what bills have to do. It was just sort of passed as is by the House and signed into law the very next day by President Johnson. This was done against a backdrop of, again, massive urban unrest, including in the United States Capitol, including at the Capitol building. And the picture that I have here is of National Guard troops guarding the Capitol at the same time as the legislators were voting on this bill. So when I talk to the students, when we learn about the Fair Housing Act, I want them to understand that this was something that was extremely hard fought and that did not come easy at all. And we may take it sort of for granted now and not think much about, you know, it's just another thing that happened back in the 60s, but this was something that really was paid for in blood in a lot of ways. So with that, we move to the present day. And so I'll talk about the law, and I'll talk about housing discrimination more generally. And then I'll talk about some of the issues that I see kind of at the forefront right now. So first of all, housing discrimination is a hard thing to get a handle on because the vast majority of it goes unreported. Like with many things, a lot of times people either don't realize it's happening to them, or they do think something's happening to them, but they don't know who to take their complaint to, or even if their complaint is one that could be redressed by the law. Or they've just simply got, you know, many people may have too many other things happening in their lives to think about trying to go pursue some sort of a complaint or a court case. So the National Fair Housing Alliance, which is the best source of data that we have on this subject, estimates that there is about 4 million instances of housing discrimination that occur every year. That translates to about roughly 34,000 complaints that are made to various federal, state, local, and nonprofit entities. Now, not every complaint equals a verifiable incident of discrimination, but if we consider the fact that, you know, there are many, many more instances than we will ever have complaints, this is clearly an undercount. I think everybody in this area recognizes that. We look at those complaints and we can analyze them to see kind of what they're alleging, and we can get some information back from that. The protected characteristics under the federal statute, as Mayor Buffalo mentioned, are race and color. Those are treated separately. But if we combine those complaints, that's 17% of the complaints that are made have an allegation of race discrimination. Just 5% have national origin discrimination. National origin is considered to be, it's a little bit tricky to define, but it's often defined as being a person's ethnicity or ancestry. That has a big overlap with race, which would take, we spend a whole class period on that when I'm teaching this, but I won't do that now. Religion complaints are fairly rare. Only 1% of the complaints come with that. Sex discrimination complaints, about 7.5%. The really big one is disability. Disability complaints are over half of all of the complaints that are made. And there's some pretty clear reasons for that, which I'll get to in a little bit. And then finally, familial status, which is defined as whether or not the household contains a child under the age of 18. And so that can be, you know, a parent-child relationship or any custodial relationship with a child. So those are the protected characteristics that the statute has, and those are the numbers of complaints that come in percentage-wise, or at least the percentage numbers of complaints. The first three, sort of race, color, national origin, and religion, are the ones that were in the original statute. Sex got added kind of as an afterthought in 1974. It just got kind of thrown in an unrelated bill. And then disability and familial status were added in 1988 when Congress amended the Fair Housing Act in some pretty substantial ways. And one of the things it did was it added those two characteristics. And I think both of them are pretty important and worth mention, not just because disability complaints comprise such a significant percentage of the complaints, but also this was the first major civil rights statute that covered, you know, wide swaths of private housing or private entities to cover disability. The ADA didn't get passed until 1990. So the Fair Housing Act was actually the first. There was an employment statute that focused only on federal employees and federal contractors called the Rehab Act. But the Fair Housing Act was really the most significant remedial civil rights statute, the first one to cover disability. So that's kind of a big deal, because the things that the Fair Housing Act does kind of get looked to by when we're looking at other statutes and other areas of law in this regard. And then familial status, the Fair Housing Act remains to this day the only civil rights, federal civil rights statute that uses this as a protected characteristic. This is not a protected characteristic in employment or in public accommodations or in any of our other big civil rights statutory areas. And it was really done out of a need. What happened in 1988 was sort of throughout the 70s and 80s, there'd been a very strong trend towards exclusionary practices against families with children. It was fairly routine for landlords to either prohibit children altogether, limit the number of children that could live in a unit, limit their ages, things like that. And it was getting to be a problem where huge percentages of even middle-class renter families couldn't find housing that would take them with their children. And there were multiple studies done showing that families were having to split up. Parents were having to send their kids away to go live with grandparents who had houses because they couldn't have them in their apartments, and it was becoming a really untenable situation. So this was a situation where Congress acted in response to that, and that was really a groundbreaking move, and it's not one that we see in any other statute. So I think that's pretty cool when Congress sees a problem and addresses it. It happens. And then we've also got some other protected characteristics just here in Colombia. States and localities are able to add to the protections that are in the federal statute. And Colombia has chosen to do so in a couple of ways. Colombia explicitly protects sexual orientation and gender identity or expression. Now, I want to take a moment because the federal statute doesn't say that on its face. The federal statute just prohibits discrimination based on sex. However, in 2020, the Supreme Court was interpreting Title VII, which is the employment discrimination statute that also prohibits sex discrimination. And when it was interpreting that statute, the Supreme Court said, "We believe sex also includes sexual orientation and gender identity or expression." So the Supreme Court interpreted that phrase to include these characteristics in the employment setting. Most experts, most legal entities assume that also will apply in the Fair Housing Act. It hasn't been really brought as a court case. The Biden administration passed some regulations saying that it should be the case. They were rescinded by the Trump administration. However, I think my professional opinion is that any court that would hear a case under the Fair Housing Act would have to kind of take the same view that the Supreme Court did in the employment context, because it's the same language, a prohibition against sex discrimination. So if the Supreme Court says that includes sexual orientation and gender identity or expression, I think that means it does in the Fair Housing Act as well. What Colombia did, though, was make it explicit, and it did that long before this Supreme Court opinion came down. So the takeaway there is, you know, I'm pretty sure the federal statute also prohibits discrimination on these bases, but I'm definitely sure that Colombia does through its municipal ordinance. Colombia also includes marital status, source of income discrimination, which includes sort of both just where somebody gets their income from, but also whether or not they're using a government benefit such as a housing choice voucher or some other kind of voucher to help subsidize their rent. And finally, status as a victim of domestic violence or as someone who has taken out an order of protection. So again, these are additional statuses that Columbia protects over and above what the federal statute protects. Going back to the national complaint data, we can also see where the complaints come from in terms of what kind of transactions generate the most complaints. And I don't think it should be any surprise that most of them come in the rental context. This is not to say that somehow people who rent housing are bad actors. It's more to say when people have housing, you have much longer ongoing relationship with a landlord than, you know, with a point of sale when that just happens and then it's over with. So the landlord-tenant relationship is the one where we see the vast majority of the complaints. I don't have the percentages broken out, but it's, as you can see, it's pretty significant, and much smaller numbers for things like sales, problems that people have with their condo or HOA boards, and then, you know, a slice for lending and appraisals. And then kind of another, the biggest bucket, the biggest other slice there is other. And that can be kind of anything from discriminatory advertising, that's kind of a big one. Harassment by neighbors is another one that can get thrown into that. That's kind of a catch-all, the way the Fair Housing Alliance takes the data. So let's look at what the Fair Housing Act prohibits so that we can get that out. The prohibitions are pretty straightforward. It prohibits discrimination in making housing available, so denial of sale or rental, or otherwise making housing unavailable. That would be evicting someone or something like that. It prohibits discriminatory terms and conditions related to housing, so discriminating in, you know, whether you provide repairs, or discriminating in the amount of a deposit that gets charged, or a down payment, or something like that. 3604C is the section that prohibits discrimination in advertising. This is a really interesting one, because this not only makes it illegal to make a discriminatory statement or have a discriminatory advertisement, but it also punishes whoever it is that publishes that advertisement. And so as a result of that, newspapers were actually found liable for carrying like classified ads that had discriminatory statements in them. So it's really interesting. Newspapers had a very big incentive to look through the ads and make sure that they weren't running ads that were discriminatory. Everything kind of changed with the internet. The internet, technically under the law, internet, you know, websites that host, you know, that host places where people can post ads should be liable as publishers under the Fair Housing Act. But there's a specific law that was passed back in 1996 called the Communications Decency Act that specifically exempts the people who host websites from liability for the content that users place on it. So if it's user-generated content, the publisher isn't liable. And so what does that mean? That means like, you know, Craigslist, which that used to be a big way that people advertised housing, or kind of any kind of roommate finder or any of these sorts of things, they won't be liable if discriminatory ads are placed on their sites, but the people placing the ads could be. And so that's just been a really interesting change, because it turns out people will still place discriminatory ads sometimes, and the host of the platform isn't liable, but the individuals could be. There aren't a lot of cases of them actually being gone after, but it's a possibility. 3604D is our provision that makes it illegal to misrepresent the availability of housing. And so the reason why we need that section, why that section is in there, kind of gets us back to the whole problem with kind of enforcing housing discrimination laws, is that people don't know when they're being discriminated against. And the best way to find out is to use testing, to send testers out. They can either be sort of official testers who are trained in, you know, recording information and sort of posing as a person who's seeking to rent or buy a property. Sometimes it's sort of informal tests. It's just someone goes to rent a property and they're told it's full, and then they ask their friend who's of a different race.
That's how we did it.
Yeah, exactly.
I would send my white girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, we call those informal tests, to make the same inquiry, and if they're told something different, that is a violation right there. And so the statute has this specific provision to help encourage testing and to actually make it a violation of the law if someone misrepresents the availability of housing to testers, even if those testers aren't technically people seeking, bona fide seekers of housing. That makes it possible to do testing and to actually use testing for enforcement purposes. A lot of civil rights organizations, fair housing groups, run testing programs. I worked at the DOJ. We had one. Many groups around the country run them. And it's just a way to sometimes just test the market and just get a sense for what's going on. Sometimes it's done for litigation purposes, and when it is, this part of the law is the one that gets used. It is also illegal to discriminate in sort of the transactions related to housing, like brokerage services, like lending, appraisals. That's been a big one in recent years. Kind of appraisal bias has kind of hit the airwaves with pretty high profile instances of, black couples putting their house on the market and having it appraised really low, going back and kind of doing a test. Kind of taking all of their artwork and family photos off the walls, having a white neighbor stand in and pretend it's them, and getting another appraisal, and it comes in $250,000 higher. So things like that have been in the news. The Biden administration put out some comprehensive guidelines and requirements for reducing appraisal bias. I'm not sure how much those are being pursued right now. But it definitely is something that is on the radar of fair housing groups. And I think the appraisal industry had kind of a wake-up call. I think they thought they were being scientific about how they were doing things, and they were sort of confronted with evidence that not always was that the case. And I think they've done a lot of re-examining of their practices and trainings and things like that. Finally, and this is one that I kind of specialized when I was practicing, The law makes it illegal to harass, intimidate, or coerce people who are enjoying their housing, which just means, exercising their fair housing rights that we all have, or interfering with people who are attempting to help people exercise or enjoy their fair housing rights. So you can't, this is the section that would also prohibit retaliation against someone for trying to help people exercise their fair housing rights. So this is a pretty useful section. It has kind of a wide utility because it can apply to all sorts of conduct. So this could apply if neighbors don't like it that a particular family has moved in and harassed them. The neighbors could actually be liable under the Fair Housing Act. This is one part of the statute that can apply to just about anybody, and it can be used by a lot of people. So it could be used by a fair housing advocate who gets harassed for trying to help people exercise their fair housing rights, or a rental agent who gets fired because they decide to rent to someone that, of a protected characteristic that their employer doesn't want them to, things like that. So this is a section that I used a lot in my practice, and I'll talk a little about the kinds of stuff that I did because it's starting to be a bigger deal now. First, I want to just finish talking about some of these provisions, though. There are specific provisions just related to disability. Disability is kind of its own creature under the law, in large part because there's not just a non-discrimination requirement. There's also sort of some affirmative obligations that housing providers have. The most significant one is reasonable accommodations. And I know for a lot of landlords, this is the biggest headache. This is actually the single biggest area of complaint that we see. Of the 56% of all complaints are disability related. Almost all of those are reasonable accommodation complaints. Not all, but a huge, huge percentage. Reasonable accommodation says that a landlord or other housing provider has to make reasonable accommodations to policies or procedures where that would be necessary to have to help someone with a disability use and enjoy the housing on an equal basis. And so that, you know, the classic example is allowing someone to have a service animal where otherwise there would be a no animal policy. There might be things like parking accommodations or accommodations related to letting people have visitors that they might need to have come provide home health care, where there might be sort of restrictions on things like visitor parking or things like that. So there's a lot of cases about this. It is seems to be a constant area of friction. Part of this is because the law anticipates that people will request accommodations clearly and state, you know, clearly, you know, be able to communicate their reasons for needing one, and that, you know, housing providers will then have an interactive process and that they'll work together to find a good outcome. And that probably happens a lot. I certainly hope that happens a lot, but it clearly also breaks down a lot. Mm-hmm. Like support animals? It does. Yeah. The Fair Housing Act includes support animals as well. Support animals are not required in other settings like transportation or restaurants, things like that. But the position for the Fair Housing Act is that if someone, a support animal is an animal that a person needs to have live with them. They may need to take it everywhere, but they need to have it reside with them. And so, yeah, that's a big, big, tricky area where there is a lot of back and forth, I would say. Yeah. There's one final affirmative. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the Fair Housing Act says that a housing provider should permit reasonable modifications to the physical structure that might include, you know, installing a ramp or grab bars, things like that. It has to be reasonable, right? So they don't want people sort of tearing everything up. It has to be the kind of thing that the tenant could undo when they leave, if the landlord wants that. Some housing providers might be okay with keeping it, but so it sort of there's a reasonableness requirement, but it is an affirmative obligation that a housing provider is supposed to permit reasonable modifications made at the tenant's expense. The landlord doesn't have to pay for it; they just need to allow it under the law. So I guess what I would say about that is it is actually pretty straightforward in the sense that if it requires housing providers who offer housing to accept a housing choice voucher if someone is seeking to rent with one. It doesn't require housing providers to lower their rents or anything like that. But if someone is renting at a rate that would be the kind that someone could use a housing choice voucher for, it requires them to accept that. There had been in some other cases across the country some dispute sometimes about sometimes statutes wouldn't be worded very clearly or ordinances wouldn't be worded very clearly, and they'd say, you know, they would just say source of income, but they wouldn't specify that that also included voucher usage. And so there would be times when courts would say, well, if they don't specify that that also requires accepting a voucher, then that isn't included. But I think Columbia's ordinance was recently amended to specifically make clear that it is to include that. So now that does. Without that, it would still protect discrimination based on other lawful sources of income, like if someone relies on certain government benefits or things like that. But with the added language to make it clear that it covers vouchers, then it definitely does. Yeah. I mean, that would be exactly what that was intended to reach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I think those are those are certainly the things that, in all the various jurisdictions where this has been something that's been passed into law, those have been the concerns. The notion that it's not just non-discrimination, it's also having to take on an obligation to do some more paperwork, allow more inspections, those kinds of things. I guess one of the things I can't speak to your experience of actually being in the room like that, but I think one of the things that is so important for us to think about, and I've got a couple slides on this a little later, but that vouchers are pretty much our nation's solution to affordable housing. That is what Congress passed into law decades ago. We did have public housing that's kind of transitioning away. Right now, the solution that we have is vouchers. So as a nation, we have decided the single best thing we can do to help house low and low moderate income families is to give them vouchers and help them get out into the private market. But we didn't get from Congress a corresponding mandate that people accept those vouchers. And so that's where kind of a disconnect occurred. And so that's the problem that jurisdictions that have passed these protections are trying to solve, is that we have a resource, really one of the only resources, or at least the main one, that as a national policy we've decided on, but it can be difficult to utilize that resource if we can't all get on the same page. And so I think the jurisdictions that have passed this have, that's been the motivating force behind it is, you know, without this, we don't have much other significant options for providing affordable housing. This is the route we've chosen to go as a country, is kind of a private market one with subsidies. And so ways to make that more effective is the best thing we can do for affordable housing. That's what I think is my takeaway from it. Any other questions about that? I'm going to talk more about affordable housing in a moment, because obviously that is top of mind for everybody. I did want to talk a little bit just about, there's one final affirmative obligation in the statute, and that is the obligation that HUD and all of the entities that HUD provides grants to, which includes pretty much every municipality in the country, housing authorities, all manner of sort of entities that take HUD money and push it out into communities, have to do so in a way that affirmatively furthers fair housing. And that has been interpreted to mean not just don't discriminate, because for a long time there was a lot of discrimination with federal dollars. So it doesn't mean just don't discriminate. It also means sort of try to act proactively, be positive and affirmative in trying to make sure that money isn't being used to entrench segregated patterns, that money isn't, you know, that money is being given to entities who understand their obligations and who are going to work to make sure the money is spent in a way that helps the goals of the Fair Housing Act. That's an underappreciated provision, but it's definitely an important one. And I know folks who work for the city have to think about that, because they have to talk about it when they apply for the grant money that they get from HUD. A couple of things that I am watching now. I didn't do a slide on appraisal bias, but that's definitely been something that's been in the news and has been kind of addressed by policymakers in the last couple of years, trying to raise awareness, get better practices and procedures, things like that. Another big one that's something that I've been personally involved with are efforts by the DOJ and HUD, but really also working with local governments and community partners to address the problem of sexual harassment in housing. This is not something I think most people even know happens. But when I was a lawyer, this was probably 75% of my docket, and I practiced all over the country, of landlords harassing their low-income female tenants. So HUD and DOJ back in 2019 decided to get together and create public awareness about it and try to step up enforcement for it. And their enforcement has quadrupled just in the last couple of years. So that's something that I'm very heartened by. Other interesting things that are going on, AI, it's everywhere. I don't know. I mean, our technocratic overlords may be controlling our thoughts in a few years. I don't know. But what I do know is that they control a lot of what we see on the internet, and there's a good deal of concern about algorithmic bias. Facebook, now Meta, recently had a pretty significant settlement because of its targeted ads in Facebook. It was targeting housing ads towards users based on protected characteristics. It didn't say it was doing that, and I think it quite possibly didn't even mean to be doing it, but the way its algorithm was written, it was definitely doing that. You could create two profiles and switch one protected characteristic and see completely different housing ads. A similar problem is happening with automated systems that a lot of companies are using now to, you know, do underwriting for when people are trying to take out loans, or do tenant screening for background checks for tenants. An entity called SafeRent, which may be used, I think it's pretty used pretty commonly for a tenant screening, just had to pay a $2.3 million settlement because its algorithm was incorporating racial bias into its screening. I don't know how computers work, but it was incorporating elements that created racial bias. So, yes.
On that right
Oh, yeah? Okay. Yeah, we may hear. Yeah, and so it's a big area, and it's tricky because we want to use tools, we want to use smart tools, we want to make, you know, we want good data, we want to, you know, save time and energy that it might spend to do a lot of this complicated work, but there is definite concern in the housing space and in other spaces that sometimes these tools have components in them that we don't even know are in there, that they may not even know are in there, as the machine learning kind of takes place. And so it's really tricky, and it's something that housing scholars and civil rights scholars are paying very close attention to. So I would encourage anybody, if you do use these kinds of tools, to be very careful about them, and make sure that there is also a human being involved in this decision making as well. Sometimes we think machines are less biased, but it turns out they can be just as biased, if not more, because kind of they have to focus on their inputs, and if their inputs aren't working well, then their outputs might be bad, but we might not realize it because we might think, oh, it's coming from a computer, therefore it's reliable. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there'd be two things there. One would be, I believe some of those are actually now being the subject of some antitrust litigation because price controlling, you know, price setting on a grand scale can be problematic from an antitrust, anti-competitiveness position. If that is being done in any way, shape, or form where it disparately impacts certain groups, that would also be a problem under the Fair Housing Act. So if it's doing it only for certain, you know, neighborhoods or types of housing or communities, that might also create some civil rights problems. Yeah. Another development, so much of what we do depends on funding to do it. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I think we all read the news and hear about it. But what I will say is the lion's share of fair housing enforcement is actually done by private entities that get grants through HUD. They're called FIPs, Fair Housing Initiative Programs. They do more than 75% of the work in this space. And they, as of most recently, had over half their funding canceled. A judge just put that on hold. Who knows what's going to happen, but there's a lot of up in the air. HUD's office that does a lot of this work just had 3/4 of its staff cut. I just heard today on the radio that they're about to sell HUD's building or put it up for sale in Washington, D.C. So, you know, the agency is taking some hits, and a lot of that means that that's going to trickle down into the people who do enforcement and kind of community development work, and it just remains to be seen how far and how long that goes. That's all I have to say about that. Finally, some other developments that are clearly top of mind for everybody is affordable housing. And so this is, it's a national crisis. You know, it is hitting everybody, you know, all, you know, big cities, smaller cities, towns, you name it. There is a huge just shortage of housing. After the mortgage crash, the financial crisis in 2008 caused by mass foreclosures, housing starts pretty much ground to a halt. And they were just starting to finally get back to thinking about getting back on track, and then COVID hit. And so the supply itself can't keep up with the demand. There are a lot of other forces, inflationary forces and whatever, that are boosting those housing costs up. You know, I have lots of graphs. You can see just about any of them that show, you know, the cost of actual buying a home has gone up. The cost of rent has gone up, and depending on how you measure it, this is the cost of rent like pegged to inflation. That's the cost of rent not pegged to inflation, and that is just sort of just alarming in every way. And I like to, when we, it's really distressing. Because what this means is even kind of people of moderate incomes are going to be affected by this. It's not a low-income problem anymore. It's definitely a low-income problem, but it's starting to creep up into people with more moderate level of incomes. And, you know, that is a fair housing issue because there's a huge amount of overlap, obviously, between the renter population is disproportionately likely to be people of color, to be families headed by a single parent who is female, families that contain children, families with people with disabilities. Many of our protected characteristics are wrapped up in the position in the group of people who are most affected by this. When we talk about affordability, I just want to show this little slide with some info. When we talk about affordability, what we mean is the ability to afford housing without it kind of taking over the entire budget of one's family. And so the Low Income Housing Task Force deals with this issue. And the common measure of affordability is a household that doesn't spend more than 30% of its income on housing. So you are considered cost burdened if you do, and then you're severely cost burdened if you spend more than half of your income on housing. Because if you think about that, if you're spending half or more of your income on housing, that doesn't leave much left over for all the other things, for the bills, medical care, food, gas, all the other things that you have to pay for. And that means that you are in an exceedingly vulnerable position. Those are the people who are, you know, one missed shift away from eviction, foreclosure, what have you. And so the National Low Income Housing Coalition has done this analysis where they have found that in no state or county in the United States can a person who is working full-time at minimum wage afford a two-bedroom apartment. Now, again, we know people are still living in apartments, but they're living in apartments that they can't afford, that they're this close to losing just at just about any turn. And so I pulled the statistics for Missouri and for Columbia. And so what the National Low Income Housing Coalition has come up with is what they call the housing wage, and that's what you would need to earn in order to afford a one-bedroom or a two-bedroom house or apartment. And we can see here that it's significantly higher than what Missouri's minimum wage was. And I don't know if it will be with the changes in the law. But so that's disturbing, and that's of concern for sure. So what I want to do now with the last couple minutes that I have is actually talk about some bright spots when it comes to housing affordability. And that means I'll sort of take off my professor hat and put on my housing commissioner hat. Because we do have a wonderful entity that does nothing but work on housing affordability, and that's the Columbia Housing Authority. And I'm gonna use the pronoun we when I talk about what the Housing Authority does, because I am committed to the work, and I feel, you know, a strong affiliation towards them. But what I really mean is Randy Cole and his extremely dedicated staff, because they're the ones that actually are doing the yeoman's work day in and day out of getting the funding, getting the properties fixed up, working with residents, the whole deal. Yes, so they deserve huge, huge, huge thanks from our whole community. And so just some information. Columbia Housing Authority is the biggest landlord in town. I don't know. They own 750 units. They manage 1,200 vouchers, which means they serve 2,000 households roughly, which translates to about 4,500 individuals annually. And that includes, I think a lot of people sometimes don't understand all the types of housing that is wrapped up in the umbrella of the Housing Authority, but that includes housing for veterans, family housing, elderly and near elderly, and people with disabilities. So it's a large group, of the resident population. And there's been a lot going on lately. Big things are happening. We have significant redevelopment projects, and that includes building new, renovating existing, converting existing over into what's called a RAD project, which is rental assistant demonstration, which means basically the Columbia Housing Authority manages properties that are also being paid for using Section 8 vouchers or housing choice vouchers, which is a much better funding model because it allows the Housing Authority to make capital improvements and raise the money to do that, to make sure that the buildings are efficient, modern, and all of those good things. Kinney Point is brand new. It is the first new housing being built by the Housing Authority in decades, a long time. And it's 34 units, and the ground was broken over the summer, and it is on track, and it's really exciting. That is, you know, we're going to have 163 units, either newly built or freshly renovated, that are going to be the kind of housing that should not only be sort of, again, modern, efficient, well-constructed housing that should last for decades to come. So that is really exciting. This also has a lot of benefits for the community, because the projects need people to, you know, we have people that work on them. We subcontract, and so a lot of those are jobs that are here in Boone County. It also means that these properties, once they become Housing Authority properties, through the RAD process, they generate income and taxes are paid on that, so that increases the tax base. And then one thing that I think is really important is that part of the services that the Housing Authority provides are things like coaching, counseling for families who want to pursue self-sufficiency. And so we have there's a family self-sufficiency program that helps households save money. It helps match some of their money that they put aside for savings to escrow to actually buy or move into their own housing in the private sector. Over the past 3 years, roughly 100 families every year have been able to do that. And currently, I was told just this morning that the family self-sufficiency escrow account has $476,000 in it, and that is resident savings. So that's people who are residents who've been saving so that they can eventually move out of housing and buy a home or get into their own rental home. So that is all really encouraging news. Finally, I would like to thank the city and the county for support in all of these projects. They have combined given $12 million to help support some of these redevelopment and new construction projects. And in particular, I want to thank Mayor Buffalo. She initiated a resolution of support for the Park Avenue and Blind Boone projects that are in process right now. It really can't happen without kind of the full level of support from the community, and we really, really appreciate that. So I see a question. Yes. To be a client of the Housing Authority. To be a subcontractor. You know what? There had been a bullet point, and I think I left it out because I was trying to not have the slide have too much information on it. But that is a target that the Housing Authority works towards for minority and women-owned businesses. When we're subcontracting. And I should have, yeah. Randy Cole will know that. And it really is. I left that off of the slide just because it was so crowded. I was trying to make the, not have it not be too crowded. But yeah, there is statistics on that. And there's a metric there. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean the insurance is a very huge and troubling piece of all of this. So I guess what I would say is, with respect to fair housing, it's not exactly doesn't exactly map onto a fair housing framework, just because it would appear to be non-discriminatory. It's just a sort of unfortunate confluence of events that's what's happening. I am reasonably sure that there are some programs that the city has in place and the Housing Authority has in place for working with landlords to help get their properties fixed up so that they would meet the requirements that HUD has for, you know, basic habitability and things like that. I'm probably not the best person to speak to those, so hopefully others will have some more information.
Their side of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And I mean, rising insurance rates has been a really huge thing that happened really fast, faster than the rise in rents, you know, kind of is on a, you know, diagonal. Rise in insurance is on like almost a vertical.
Exactly.
And that's a cost that gets borne by property owners. And it's something the Housing Authority is having to grapple with as well. And it's, yeah. So that would like the clients, for example. Yeah. And that would be, I would probably need Randy to speak more clearly to that, but I know there's, you know, there's an application process and a whole background check process. And yeah, I mean, I know there's vetting procedures because, you know, we have there's a long wait list. And so for every person that, you know, gets a voucher, there's 10 people on the waiting list. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're getting as many out there that can be used appropriately as possible. We have voucher specialists that work with all of this a lot. And yeah, so. Yeah, no, and I think it behooves any, you know, it, like I was saying before, like if this is going to be our main way of helping to support affordable housing is through vouchers, that behooves us to make it, you know, easier and, you know, to not make it an onerous process for landlords to participate in it. I mean, that's, you know, we are relying on housing providers to be the piece of that puzzle. And I think obviously government processes should be working to help make that a better, as good a process as it can be. You know, so it sounds like there might be some low-hanging fruit about inspections and things like that that, you know, would be worth looking at. Again, that's not, that wouldn't be my call, but but it's, that sounds like a, you know, like a, an idea worth thinking about. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I when I teach this to my students, I'm always like this, I call this the, this is why we can't have nice things rule is because, yeah. And I think HUD has voluminous regulations that are not binding on people who are not participating in the HUD process, but are informative, but they're long and, you know, would take, it's like reading the phone book. So yeah, I mean, I sympathize for the situation because it isn't, it's kind of a gray area. Yeah, yeah. That is a good question. I don't know. I do this often in April, but yeah. Do you have a answer to that, or was that more of a question? Yeah, there's, yeah, we got here. Then even more?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I will wrap it up then. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Becky Thompson. I'm the director of the city's Housing and Neighborhood Services Department. Thank you so much, Professor Oliveri. I was lucky enough to have Professor Oliveri as a law professor a long time ago, but it's such a treat to get to hear her speak and continue to learn from her. So such a great resource. Thank you. So the city created the Department of Housing and Neighborhood Services about a year ago, a little over a year ago, with the recognition that we do need to focus more on affordable housing in the community. As you've heard today, the lack of housing and the lack of affordable housing is a real issue. But I want to focus on the bright spots as well today and talk a little bit about some of the important projects that we've been able to be a part of over the past year. That's included completing a housing study in partnership with the county, with Boone County, that really allowed us to understand the market analysis of the housing in Columbia and what our housing needs are as a community. We held a housing summit that had nearly 200 of our community members attend and really engaged in discussion about how we implement those recommendations in order to meet those housing needs. We're now in the process of working with the county and all of our community partners to implement those recommendations. It's also included focusing on increasing the capacity of the city's own internal affordable housing programs. That includes our homeownership assistance program, our rehab and energy efficiency program. And it's the work of our neighborhood services department that's daily working with our landlords and our tenants, with our homeowners and neighborhoods to ensure that we have a housing stock that's well maintained and we have neighborhoods that continue to be safe and vibrant. And we've also been creating new programs. We created a home weatherization program that opened applications in October and since that date has provided attic and crawl space insulation to nearly 150 homes, and we're now moving on to provide HVAC and hot water heater systems as well. But I think most importantly, it's our partnership with the other organizations in this community that are daily engaged with providing housing opportunities for those most in need. You heard from Professor Oliveri about the work that Columbia Housing Authority has done, which has been fantastic. But I want to introduce a few other of the organizations and representatives of those organizations that are here today to talk a little bit about the work that their agencies are doing. I'm sure they could all talk for hours about what they're engaged in, but I'm trying to limit them to 5 or 10 minutes. So here today we have the, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce them all, and then you guys can just come up one by one. But we have the Program Director for Love Columbia, Conrad Hake. We have the Executive Director for Central Missouri Community Action, Darren Priest. The president of the Columbia Community Land Trust, Anthony Stanton, and the director of community outreach at Show Me Central Habitat for Humanity, Ashley Schweitzer. So, Conrad, if you want to come on up.
Thank you, Becky, and thank you, Rigel, for your presentation this morning. And it seems like that the stage has kind of already been set with some of what we're doing at Love Columbia. But I want to share a little bit about some of what we have done, what we are doing, and a couple of our dreams. And it's very pertinent to even what we heard about today. Oftentimes, some of our grassroots marketing at Love Columbia is that, well, if you're behind on rent or if you need a place to live, go to Love Columbia. Call Love Columbia. I don't know what they're going to do for you, but they're going to help you. That's fairly true, but at the same time, I also want to look at, like, what does that actually look like? How do we do that? We strive to help our neighbors improve their finance, housing, and employment to create the lives that they want through our coaching classes and supportive services. And that's really the core of what we offer is coaching classes and supportive services. And we strive to serve the whole person and engage the whole community. So we're collaborative when we're trying to look upstream and look at what is contributing to the situation that someone's been experiencing. And one example that happened earlier this month that I think is very pertinent to what Rigel has shared so far is that we operate a rent assistance program that's been generously funded by the city. We call it the CARE program, the City Assistance for Rent and Eviction. And that's available to residents of the city of Columbia that earn 50% or less of the area median income and are behind on rent. And we want to operate that program to help our community. But it's not just a financial assistance program. It helps people get connected with supportive services and whatever might help prevent their sustainability going forward. So we use our programs to do that. We use community programs to help support that as well. We had a tenant contact us earlier this month, and they were behind on rent. They had a hiccup with their employment, and they were facing some discrimination by their landlord that was pressuring them for ways to pay their rent other than financial means, let's put it that way. And this is happening in Columbia. These are not necessarily what you would consider slumlords. This is just a landlord looking to take advantage of a tenant. And we were working with this tenant, and we could have just paid that back rent and helped them get caught up so they could avoid that. But that's not how we wanted to help in this situation. It wasn't going to provide what this person needed for safety. And unfortunately, at times, we are kind of in a tough spot when we're trying to work with somebody to choose safety over justice. And how do we work with this person to try to make this situation right, to try to address what's happening so that it doesn't happen to other people in our community? But this person is feeling the significant power imbalance of being a tenant in a property where if they speak out, they could lose their home. They'll be on the street. They have no resources. They have nowhere to go. They're in this situation because they don't have those resources. So our staff, we're working with this person to help them advocate for themselves, to offer the opportunity to file complaints, to put them up into a safe place, to help them work with Mid-Missouri Legal Services, to negotiate lease terms, and then to find new, safe, affordable housing for them. So while we are a place that can help people that are behind on their rent, we're listening to the story, we're getting into the background, and we're trying to help the entire situation. Volume is an issue, and if there's any issue that we run into at Love Columbia, it's just trying to have the capacity to serve everybody that has needs just like that in our community. But that's really what our heartbeat is, that's our passion, and we're trying to utilize the resources that are available and our community partners to collaborate together to really do that. Looking at what we've been able to do in both rental housing and then also homeownership over the last year, we were able to help 1,200 people prevent eviction or obtain permanent housing last year. And we're really proud of that number because that's a number that involves people staying in their homes, people that were able to maintain affordability of their homes, or people that were able to get out of an unhoused situation or a doubled up situation and get back on their feet again. We also saw 40% of people that participated in our homeownership program purchase homes over the last year. And that's a program that we've been, yep. That's an exciting number. Because we also, as we're working on homeownership, we're kind of looking at, well, what's preventing people from owning a home? Well, their credit score. So we have a pre-homeownership credit building program. And that's really, really at Love Columbia what we do. If you want to get down to the nuts and bolts of it, we start just pulling at threads and finding out, well, what does it start unraveling? What goes from there? What do people need to end up getting to where they want to be? So we have a pre-homeownership program to help with credit building. We're also launching post-purchase support for people that have purchased a home, but it's maybe their first home, and they don't have a lot of awareness about, should I take out a home equity loan? What do I do about maintenance? How do I plan for some of the appliances or systems that might need replacement down the road or a new roof? What do I need to know about my deeds and how to keep this property within my family, or what I should do in case something happens to me? So we're working on some post-purchase education as well in partnership with other community members for that. We're excited about offering those in the next few months, hopefully this summer. We're also working closely, again, with other attorneys and Mid-Missouri Legal Services to help offer that, like, tangled titles for people that are trying to figure out properties in the first ward, and especially what was mentioned earlier, and how can I do something with the property that I have so that it doesn't just sit vacant, but that something can be done with it. It can become new housing stock, or it can get back onto the market again. We have a few projects that are coming up this year. If you've driven by Ash and Walnut or off of College, you've seen our 10-unit transitional housing project that's under development currently. We expect that to open at the end of this year or early 2026, and that's a project that was generously funded by the city and the county and other community partners. Great example of public-private partnership to see new properties come onto the market, to see some of the multifamily properties within the first ward that can add gentle density to our community and that can also serve families that are coming out of homelessness. Someone mentioned earlier our Rent Well tenant training program. That's a program that we launched the beginning of last year. It's a nationally accredited program, and it's intended to help tenants be just what was mentioned over here before, to be a desired tenant, to learn some of the skills of good tenancy, to learn how to communicate with your landlord, to break some previous patterns and learn why things haven't been working so far. And it also is a collaborative project as well. We have housing providers that share about their experience so that someone can meet a landlord, and it's not just that nasty person on the other end of a text message or the person that posts things on their door. It's someone that they can meet and understand where are they coming from, what's going on. Just yesterday, our class met, and we had an attorney from Missouri Legal Services that's provided a video on tenant rights and responsibilities to share about what those what a tenant can expect, to share about fair housing, to help educate and empower our tenants. That class is every Thursday at 3 o'clock, and we have information on our website about how to participate in that. We would love more housing providers in Columbia to refer your tenants prior to eviction, and then we can help with some of the mediation or arbitration, not necessarily legally, but we can talk with a landlord, represent the tenant, and try to bring people together so that there can be a path forward. Sometimes that involves working with our other community partners, like Mid-Missouri Legal Services. Sometimes that's something that we can do individually, just helping the tenant understand this is what you need to pay on your rent. Can you actually develop a payment plan? And what would that look like for you to follow that? So we try to work closely, and we would love to have more housing providers involved in that process so that we can work with people prior to that eviction notice. That's really what our heart would be, is that if we can help as things start to go bad so that we can help bridge those gaps, then we can help prevent those evictions from being filed. Maybe it means an opportunity to move out without an eviction. Maybe it means being able to stay in that property. But that's a lot of what we're able to do as well through the resources that we have. Lastly, just want to talk a little bit about some of our homeownership projects as well. One is, Verna, you wanted me to talk about another dream that we have. So let me finish with that one, because I think that's really a big deal. Several years ago, we started exploring the idea of what would it look like to have a single platform where a tenant could apply to multiple properties, and then a housing provider also had access to a tenant pool, but supportive services as well. Many of the people that we work with at Love Columbia and our community, they have supportive services because they have some kind of gap or barrier that's preventing them from applying to a property in the normal sense. They're getting turned down because of a felony or because of an eviction or because of some mental health needs that they might have, and they have a case manager or supportive services there, or they have a voucher, but they're having trouble finding a place. And we have been working with the Housing Access and Support Alliance. There's an organization out of St. Louis that has a project that has already been down this road. And so we've been talking with them about what could it look like in Columbia for us to have a place where landlords and supportive service agencies and tenants could all be on that same platform, and a single place to apply so that you only have to pay one application fee. And then the landlord, on the other hand, also has access to that supportive service provider. So you have somebody that you can go to. You're not just going to the tenant and the tenant's not responding potentially because of fear or, you know, lack of skills or whatever that might look like, but you now have a case manager you can go to. You can talk to them and you can bring them into the situation. They can go to the tenant that they already have that relationship with and try to work something out. So that's still in the very, very dream stages. It's a new project that we're trying to explore with the Housing Access and Support Alliance, but it's something that we're very excited about the potential that could provide. Because again, if we can help avoid people from going into eviction, then we can, I think the whole community wins, because the landlord doesn't have to file, the tenant doesn't have it on their record, and we're also promoting skill development and communication and collaboration between, you know, both parties. So that's something we're excited about as well.
Morning, everybody. I'm Darren Priest, Executive Director of Central Missouri Community Action. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. It's great to see so many people interested in these issues. Conrad took 20 minutes, so I'm going to take 20 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. I'll try to keep it brief. I do want to say, as a personal point, Love Columbia is just a fantastic organization. We have so many partners across the community that are doing such great work trying to help move people out of poverty, create stability, really improve the quality of our community overall. Anybody that says, you know, there's all these nonprofits duplicating services, I got to say first, nobody seems to have a problem with a bank on every corner. We need lots of nonprofits because we all have different nuances and different niches, and we want to make sure that we're serving people in the way they want to be served. So having incredible partners like Love Columbia and the Columbia Housing Authority and Voluntary Action Center and JobPoint, I could go on and on with all of those that are represented in the room. It's so important, and it makes our community strong. So Central Missouri Community Action's mission is to build relationships to empower people, strengthen resilience, and improve quality of life for all members of the community. As long as there's poverty with us, then our community is not reaching its full potential. So that's what we're working on. So I'm going to highlight four different programs real quick that are addressing housing affordability issues. The first is LIHEAP, everybody's favorite. That's the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. It has two components. It's energy assistance, which is just a flat payment to utility providers that's based on your income. That program is available from November through May, and you can get assistance based on your level of income and the type of utility you have. So tank propane, for example, we can give a little over $500 for that, whereas like electric is about $326 that you can get through that program. The other side of the LIHEAP program is ESIP. That's the Energy Crisis Intervention Program. And that's available when someone's utilities are under threat of disconnect. So under that program, between November and May, we can provide $800 of assistance. And that can come in multiple payments. You know, if it's $300 1 month and then $400, that adds up, yeah. $400 the next month, and we can still pay on both of those, and there's still another $100 available. The summer program, which will start June 1st, only has $300 available. That's going to be tough for folks. That's lower. It was double that during the COVID years, but it's back down to $300. This is a state stipulation. We're a contractor with the State Department of Social Services. So what that means is if you've got a $400 bill, you've got to pay $100, and then we can come in with the $300. So that's a really important thing to note. That can only be used for your power source. So it can't be used for water, sewer, trash, those types of things. So in the city of Columbia, you can go to the city and you can ask for a non-utility payment and pay that part of your bill first, keep that receipt, bring it with you, and then we can pay on the utility side of it. So we've processed 6,918 applications so far this year. I expect we'll do a couple thousand more. So that's a large program that serves many, many people, and it's really important for helping keep the lights on and also making it so people don't have to choose between lights and their medicine or food or school supplies or whatever else it might be. The second I want to mention is our weatherization program. So I'm saying these in the order of impact because weatherization makes homes permanently more energy efficient, or not permanently, but at least 15 years. We can only do them once every 15 years. That's a program that's based on the home. So it can be a homeowner that gets weatherization assistance, or it can be a renter. But the intervention stays with the home. So if another renter moves into that same unit later, that unit can't be weatherized again for another 15 years. This is a program, basically, we go to the home. Ben, I'm gonna simplify this tremendously. Ben is our housing development director over that program. We basically tape up a fan in the front door, we blow air into the unit, and then we measure the pressure, and then we can see where it's leaking. And then we do lots of insulation in the walls and the roof. We do HVAC, those types of things to make the home more energy efficient. And that is a program that really, you know, it can save $50 to $100 a year or a month on utility bills. So that's a tremendous help. We typically weatherize between 100 and 120 homes a year. About half of those are in Boone County. So we've done about 48 homes so far this year in Boone County. The next program I want to mention is the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We do not do this in Boone County. That's the Columbia Housing Authority that provides that. But we operate the Mid-Missouri Public Housing Agency that has vouchers in the six counties around Boone County. Most of those go to Cole and Callaway County. But I mention that just because we see some movement and migration in and out of Boone County all the time. So we've got 367 vouchers for that program and 434 on the wait list. So the wait list is closed right now. That's, you know, we open it, we have more availability, but it's closed right now. Someone mentioned the Family Self-Sufficiency Program in the Columbia Housing Authority. That is such a great program. We don't have that program, but we do take the whole family approach that we use for all of our programs, which means we're looking at the circumstances of an entire family and look at all the resources that might help move them towards economic stability. And so we're applying the whole family approach to our housing tenants because we want to make sure that in addition to getting some rental subsidy, that we're also really looking at the big picture. Why do you need rental assistance? Is there something we can do to improve your circumstance, improve your income, decrease your other expenses so that ultimately we would like to see people that aren't on a fixed income with, you know, disability or seniors that move out. We want them to graduate from the housing assistance program so that they can move into market rate housing and you know, we can use those dollars for somebody that is struggling currently. Okay, and the last one I want to mention is construction. So we own six different apartment complexes through an 8-county service area that we operate. We also develop single-family homes. Right now, we just sold two single-family homes on Hickman Avenue. Right now, we're building 14 more units that are over on it's Providence, Hickman, Dysart, and 4th Street. So if you can picture that block just south of Kilgore's, hopefully you've seen some construction going on there. All of the underground infrastructure work is done. We've got the foundations down. We'll be starting to do the framing here in just really the next couple of weeks. Thanks to the city and to the county for tremendous support, sometimes emotional support, but in many ways, financial support. We've got city ARPA funds, county ARPA funds, home funds through neighborhoods, through housing and community development. And then Veterans United has been significantly helpful in this project. So we will have, these will be homes that we sell, but as condos. So it's a little bit of a twist on the housing trust model, the community trust fund model. Anthony will go over in a second. It's a little bit of a twist on that. We will maintain ownership of the land and we'll maintain exteriors for landscaping, lawn care, siding, roofs, all of the exterior stuff, mowing, snow removal, all those types of things, because we want to make sure that the property stays really, you know, nice so that the community is proud of it. It's right on Providence. We feel like we've got to keep this property up so that people can see how good affordable housing can be. So the home buyers will, we're shooting for right now with the funding we have in place, we're looking at one bedroom, one bath homes selling for about $130,000, two bedroom, one, two, and one and a half bath selling between $150 and $180, and then three bedroom, two bath homes selling for just under $200,000. So these are significantly below market rate homes, but when you think about the cost of insurance, we were just talking about insurance, the home ownership fees that people have to, the HOA fees that people have to pay, and things like property tax and things like that, we're just barely at the brink of affordability at 80% of area median income. That's the target audience for these homes. So we are applying for additional funds. We want to decrease those home sale prices. I'd like to lower them about $20,000 more so that we have a larger population of people that can afford these at that income bracket. And then just in closing, we're committed to housing development. We're already exploring a project to build an ADU on a lot that we already own. We're building 40 units down in Jefferson City. We are planning for 30 more units in Fulton and applying for low-income housing tax credits for 48 units in Mexico. So this is we're covering an 8-county geographic footprint. Affordable housing is needed desperately everywhere. And we hope to be just one small piece of the solution. So thank you for your attention.
Morning. Good morning. Y'all sleep? What's going on here? My name is Anthony Stanton. I'm the president of the Columbia Community Land Trust. Ms. Priya's kind of alluded to what we do. Build affordable housing. The difference is I make it permanently affordable. I'm trying to plant a flag in established neighborhoods, create new neighborhoods, but make those units permanently affordable. You said, well, how can you do that? Well, it was kind of alluded to by Ms. Prius. We have homeowners here. Imagine you had your house and you didn't have to pay for the land. how would that affect your house cost, your housing cost? It's kind of where we're at. We build a house, our development costs are just the same as everybody else's. So we own the land and we pull that cost out of that housing, which brings the cost of your house down. With all the other programs that you've heard here, self-sufficiency, we send off our people that buy our houses to the Love Columbia pre-housing program. All the existing support systems. I'm gonna back up. This is like the first time I've ever been in a place where you see the umbrella of affordable housing, the whole umbrella, and all these programs in a continuum. You know, we have the unhoused, and we work all the way through the fair market. And all these people that you've heard talk are all involved, and we gotta take notice of that. And be aware that we all exist and help each other move through that housing continuum.
It's happening.
It is, it is. So back to the CCLT. We were born in 2016. I hate to make this a Randy Cole hooray, hooray day, but I have to. Randy Cole's tenure at the city, the city had been trying for years to implement this community land trust model. Nobody was getting it. A combination of a conscious administration and the right leadership from Randy Cole when he was at Housing Services at the city put it all together. We had a charitable uncle at that time with the city and the mayor, and we have a charitable auntie at this time with Mayor Buffalo. And they were basically our angel investors. We're an independent 501c3. We're not the city. We're an independent 501c3 with a very gracious auntie and uncle to help fund us. We also got some ARPA money. We also have money from sales of our homes. So at this time, we have 21 units with two more coming online. Two complete developments at Lynn Street and one named after one of our founding fathers, Cullimore, Mr. Cullimore. We have Cullimore Colleges over on A Street and Rear Coats. And we're finishing that development here with two more coming online probably in July. We'll have a ribbon cutting for that. It's a great time. Now, to answer Mr. Faber's question concerning how you get in the game with CHA is Section 3, am I right, Mr. So Section 3 is specific to housing authorities and is their minority contractor situation. But as we all know, you just heard about HUD, just heard about DEI. Those things could all be in the air. So what we're doing at the CCLT is kind of reevaluating our strategic plan and making those adjustments. Doesn't mean things stop. We just got to think of them different. The demand is still there. The need is still there. This is a hot market for anybody that's in it. And there's plenty of room for all of us to be successful in it. We just have to be smart and work together primarily and share resources, not only financial, but intellectually as well. Our major rubric that we use is what you heard from the keynote speaker, that house cost burden equation. So 30% of your income should be used for your housing. And that's kind of where we work. We try to work in pricing our homes and where we buy property and all that stuff based around that 30%. And kind of work with that, plus the 80% AMI that Ms. Prius talked about earlier. That's kind of our boundaries, and we work within that space. And we're pretty much the similar price points that you heard previous. Like we learned from the housing study that was just conducted by the county, all levels of housing is needed. And affordability transfers, that 30% transfers to all incomes. And as you heard, the people that we thought were the safest with the middle income and moderate income, those are, everybody is under pressure and under stress. So it's a big problem, and we, in this room, we've got the solutions, and we can't cry about it. We need to push on and be resourceful. I'm going to make a pun here. I'm going to make a quick advertising here. The CCLT has a fundraiser at Ragtag May 1st. It is a screening of a film called The Myth of, please don't get me for this name, Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis. Okay, we're doing a screening of that movie May 1st at Ragtag, starting at 5 o'clock. So bring your thinking caps, your wallets, your interest. We'll have food and things there, and we'll have time to look at that movie. And it's good because it fits right in what we're talking about here. Educating, awareness, and then collaboration. It's all what this whole thing is about. So come and join us on May 1st at Ragtag and learn the 5 o'clock we'll start, Ragtag. Come early because we got food. You get there before I get there. So, it's a best case. It's a case study. You know, we get scared. I'm kind of on the soapbox here. A lot of us, we try to go volume. That was the angle back in the 60s and 70s. Let me build Capriti Greens and make 1,000 units. Let me make 1,000 units here because we got to house so many people. It's not the number, it's the quality, and it's the development of the neighborhood. Now, some may think it is value. From the CCLT point of view, we're concerned with neighborhoods and infrastructures and permanent affordability so that is always, the neighborhood stays as it is and grows on its own at its own pace. And this movie will kind of talk about what worked and what didn't and where that development is to this day. So sorry to take probably more time than I needed to, but I wanted to introduce another heavy hitter, Ms. Ashley Switzer from Habitat for Humanity. You're up to bat, ma'am.
Well, sorry, everyone. They all wore nice clothes, and I wore my balloon sweater, so I am so excited to be here. We have a lot going on at Habitat for Humanity. As everyone has shared, we work really closely with a lot of the different nonprofits, and in 2021, Habitat started our new subdivision called Boone Prairie. And that will eventually have 143 homeowners living out there. And every time I say 143, I freak out because I get so excited. But we have about 20 that already live out there. We have 5 that are in various stages of construction. Our subdivision is split up into 5 different phases of 30 lots. We wanted to make sure that we could put infrastructure in as we got to it, in case there was any improvements that needed to be made or whatever. But our next section of infrastructure for the next 30 lots will be put in by September, so we're so excited about that. Our applications for home ownership just closed March 29th. We had an entire month of applications coming in, and we actually received a little over 140 applications for home ownership. So that gives you a little idea of what the need looks like in Columbia. Over the past couple of years, we did a little bit of research on our homeowners that were already accepted into the program, where they came from, what they were doing, what their income was like as a whole. And it turned out that about 40% of our homeowners were on some sort of assistance before they moved into their Habitat home. And that's important because once, like they said, we are working together and everybody has their piece of the pie that they're working working on. So as Love Columbia is training up those people who need help with their credit to be able to become homeowners, our homeowners are then releasing those Section 8 vouchers or their housing authority apartments or whatever that can then help that pipeline of people who need vouchers and are on a waiting list. So while we're helping all of these different sections of people be able to achieve that next step, we're then opening up for the next group of people to be able to achieve their dreams and make their next step. So we do have Women Build coming up May 1st through the 3rd. It's going to be so very fun. Women in Construction, leading women volunteers to build women's houses. Obviously, Habitat is a fair housing organization, so we don't discriminate. But we do have two particular homeowners that are women and the head of their household. And so we're really excited to partner with them for this specific event. If you're interested in joining us for that, let me know. You can find all the information about how our applications work, how our homeownership program works, and everything on our website. You can sign up for Women Build. But know that all of the homeowners that come into our program, they do participate. They help build their house alongside the volunteers. They pay a zero interest mortgage just for the amount it costs us to build their Habitat home with volunteer labor. So without those labor costs, without the interest, it's actually affordable for them to own. And then we have partners like Love Columbia and some of our other fellow folks that help educate them to make sure that they're successful homeowners once they move in. Because you don't have a landlord anymore, and that's a lot to deal with. So we want to make sure that they're ready. So thank you very much for caring about affordable homeownership, caring about affordable housing in general, and for being here to show your support to all of these organizations, to our city, our county, and all of the different government entities that help fund us. But we can't do it without the individual people of our community that are coming alongside all of these organizations that are working so hard to make things possible. Housing is a huge burden on a lot of people in our community, and it is well-researched that a lot more of the people that we know are one major disaster away from financial ruin. And we don't think about that as our friends and neighbors. We think about that as somebody that's, you know, on the street or far away from us, but that's just not reality. So thank you for being here, for caring, for listening to all of the things that were said today. And I think it's time for lunch. So Becky, come on up.
Yeah, thanks so much, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Ashley. Thanks to our presenters. Columbia Board of Realtors has provided lunch. If you go out these doors and head to the left, it'll be in the room that's there. So thanks again for being here, everyone.